All right, in Luke chapter 16, really we're kind of picking up in the middle of a story, a kind of a little vignette that Luke is giving us. And in fact, we looked several weeks ago, I don't remember exactly when it was, we looked several weeks ago though at chapter 15, really all of chapter 15 we looked at together. It's three parables about lost things, lost sheep, a lost coin, and then a lost or the prodigal son that we were able to look at that time. Really, chapter 15 and 16, I don't know if there's my remote is working. Really, there isn't much of a gap. I don't know if we're meant to understand any time that's passing in between those two. I don't think so, because we'll see from chapter 16, kind of midway through it, you still have a lot of the same audience that's in mind as well. So as chapter 15 began, we saw Jesus addressing those three parables to the scribes and the Pharisees in particular, because they were upset. They were all miffed and disturbed over the fact that Jesus was receiving sinners and eating with them. That was after all these tax collectors and sinners, just kind of the people who were publicly known to be the worst people. Many of them, kind of knew that about themselves and maybe wanted to change that, wanted to do something different. And so they had come to Jesus and were listening attentively. They drew near him to hear him. And the Pharisees, of course, just didn't like this whatsoever. So they took exception to that. In response, Jesus told those three parables that we looked at several weeks ago, really just kind of getting across the point. If you have something that is in hand, something that's good, and you don't really need as much work to secure it, you have nine sheep at home, or 99 sheep at home, or nine coins, or whatever it might be, you don't go looking for them. But when something is lost, when something is imperiled, then you go and try and rescue it. You try and go and get it back. And that's what I'm doing. That's my whole purpose here on earth, is to find those lost things and bring them back. And the Lord takes pleasure in that. And so that's what he is telling them in those three parables there. But then in chapter 16, he'll turn his attention, Luke tells us, to his disciples and tell this parable to them. Although it's still in earshot, evidently, based on verse 14, still in earshot of the Pharisees. So I think, again, we're still in that same setting. Everyone is able to listen in, but for reasons we'll talk about later, this teaching seems to go to the disciples first and foremost, kind of giving them a warning about certain things, I think. All right, so let's look at this parable itself. Let's actually, because it is only eight verses, let's read it together, beginning in verse number one. Jesus said to his disciples, "There was a certain rich man who had a steward, and an accusation was brought to him that this man was wasting his goods. So he called him and said to him, 'What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward.' Then the steward said within himself, 'What shall I do? For my master is taking the stewardship away from me. I cannot dig. I'm ashamed to beg. I've resolved what to do, that when I'm put out of the stewardship, they may receive me into their houses.' So he called every one of his master's debtors to him and said to the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' And he said, 100 measures of oil. So he said to him, 'Take your bill, sit down quickly, and write 50. Then he said to another, 'And how much do you owe?' So he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, 'Take your bill and write 80. So the master commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light." So he's telling us a story about a steward. That's really just someone who is, we'd kind of think of it like a manager, an agent, something in that realm. Someone who has control over his estate. And really, they, in those days, could have total control. I mean, the master may not have really much idea at all of what's going on in his own home, how much of whatever he might have, what deals he has with who, and all those sorts of things. He may just be totally oblivious. The steward just handles all of it. And however, this man has not been doing such a good job. He's been wasting his goods. in verse 1. We aren't told why, and it's not really important why. Maybe he already was showing himself to be unjust. I mean, he's a crooked guy, obviously. He's okay cutting corners and lying and deceiving people. So maybe he was skimming off the top or doing something that he shouldn't have been doing. Maybe he was just incompetent. You know, maybe he just had been doing a bad job and was losing a lot of money through bad deals or whatever it might have been. I don't know. Something he's doing isn't working out, and so the master is going to get rid of him. He's just going to have to let him go. So, seeing that the writing is on the wall, it's all about to be over, he ends up making some shrewd deals that will help him to come through this without being put out onto the street just destitute. And he mentions that there in verse 3. He knows himself, at least. He gives, I guess, an accurate assessment of his own self. I can't dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I mean, I don't have the strength for manual labor, but I'm too proud of a man to be a beggar. So I got to figure something else out in order to keep living. So that's what he tries to do. What's he actually doing here when he calls these men in? That's kind of a weird thing that happens. What's going on when he calls in these debtors? Yeah, Steve. Okay, he's cutting by half, by 20%, cutting out what they owe. For what reason? I mean, I guess he kind of explains it, but what's the thought process behind that? Okay, these are, maybe these are kind of wealthy people. They're debtors, but they're dealing with big sums of money. They're dealing with big sums of these commodities. So maybe these are also wealthy people, like the man that he's been working for. I'm needing a soft place to land because I'm about to be put out on the street. And so if I can get in good with these guys, show them that I've done them a favor, maybe they'll be able to do me a favor. Really seems to be what he has in mind here. Cut these guys some slack. And apparently they're kind of just as crooked as he is. Really, everyone in the story is kind of morally bankrupt, but they figure, hey, if he's going to give me a 20% discount on this, great. They don't even question that. So maybe he figures they'll be happy to have someone like me working for them afterward, and they can just help a little bit out. It says in verse 4, they'll receive me into their houses. That lending system itself, I'll just go ahead and mention all of these at once. I don't want to spend a ton of time on it, but it is just kind of a weird setup that we see there. You know, why would this work, or how could he get away with it? The idea of getting interest back wasn't something that the Jews were supposed to do. That they weren't really supposed to, you know, demand a payment back from someone if you were loaning. So a lot of times they would just have a setup that was, we're kind of going into business together. Let's say I've given you 100 measures of oil, and we'll do something with that. And then afterward, you'll pay me back, a certain percentage of that. You'll pay me back something that would be a good return on that investment. But it's not really that you owe me a debt, and I'm taking interest, or I'm not having any usury from doing that. It's just we're business partners, and that'll be my share of our business that we've gone in together, is the way things were framed a lot of times. The steward, it seems, is still acting legally when he does this, or at least he's done it quickly enough that it would put things into question. And we would also then figure, well, the master is going to have people who are upset if he starts changing things back after they've been given some debt relief. He's just really kind of going to find himself in a difficult spot. He's got to go along with this after the steward has changed the bills. And so his response is really kind of the most unexpected part in verse 8, that he's not mad. He doesn't fight him about it. He doesn't try to have him thrown into prison, which I guess maybe he could have. I don't know. But he is just kind of grudgingly admiring of this man who is just lost him a lot of money. I mean, he wasn't doing his job well in the first place. He was ready to be done with him anyway. And now here he comes in one day, he's lost me a lot of money. Some people have calculated out, tried to figure out how much exactly we'd be dealing with. This would be like 3 years' salary for the servant. 3 years' salary at a denarius a day would be about what he's looking at here. So, he just lost me thousands of dollars through this deceitful stuff, but he's not really too upset about it. He just says, good job. You won this round. Get out of here. I don't ever want to see you again, probably, is still what's going to happen, but good on you. You played the game. And so I can only really kind of smile at that. So that's the story itself. Now, we've mentioned this before, and especially the first time you read this, I can remember the first time I read or studied this parable thinking, that's a really weird parable, isn't it? Because this guy seems like a bad guy. He doesn't seem like anyone that I should be patterning my life after. A lot of parables, when you read them, there seems to be that one guy that's kind of good. He's doing right. He's doing what you're supposed to do. And it's clear. And Jesus will maybe say something at the end, kind of, do like this. The parable of the Good Samaritan. Go and do likewise. I mean, you see the guy that you should be acting like, and he's the one that gets a gold star. He's the one that we say, that's how you should act. And it's usually good behavior. You help someone out, or you're patient with someone, or you just, you're sacrificial with whatever it might be. The Good Samaritan, another, good example. He does everything right. And if you actually did those behaviors that he was doing, you'd be doing a good job. Well, this man, we see there in verse 8, the master commended him, and Jesus seems to be drawing a positive application from what he's doing. But if you look at this guy, so does Jesus want me to swindle my boss? Does he want me to start coming home with, stealing paper clips or whatever it is I'm going to do at my office and start taking things from the company? And he wants me to, when I get in a tough spot, just lie and cheat and steal and start doing all these background deals and just try to turn everything on its head and just set a fire on my way out when I quit, just get out of... is that what Jesus is telling us to do? Well, no, clearly not. But it does make it just kind of an interesting parable to look at because it is unusual. It's bad behavior, but there is something about it that is praiseworthy. So what do we think is the primary purpose? Why is Jesus telling us this parable? What are we meant to conclude from it? Yeah, Steve. Okay.
And I think what the whole input of the main thrust of it is we need to be that way planning on for spiritual things. We need to be planning today for our salvation, our ultimate salvation in Christ.
Okay.
Accepting the gospel, obedience to his will, teaching others, that sort of thing.
Okay. I like that idea of preparation that Steve mentions there especially, and that's, I read out of the New King James that says that he had dealt shrewdly. A lot of the translations will read that he had dealt prudently, and that does typically have a connotation if you are being prudent in something, not necessarily careful, but you've been wise, especially in respect to preparation, especially in respect to time, kind of. I'm not going to act recklessly and foolishly right now because I don't know what's going to happen later on. That would be a prudent thing to do. And so he's looking at the admonition from a spiritual standpoint. You do what this man did from a physical standpoint. And the specific there, be prepared. Be planning on what's going to happen. Figuring out what the next step would be when crisis comes or when something is going to come up. Gary?
In the business world, I don't know what it was like back then, but in my lifetime, it was like that. Anyway, you got discounts, you paid things off early. I don't know what the terms were for the debt, so it may be that there was a discount available if they paid it off
Okay. Yeah. And there is, I'll mention here, there are several things that are several schools of thought, I guess, that look at this and maybe look at several different aspects of the deals that he's making here and say maybe it's not just a totally illegal thing. Maybe he's just doing something that's shrewd, you know, that's wise, maybe for everyone involved. Maybe this is something that would actually help his employer out. And so he's not actually trying to set himself up. He's showing him that I'm helping you out. Maybe you don't want to fire me. I do think, though, there in verse 4, he's already looking ahead at saying, I'm gone. He doesn't care what happens with his original employer, his original master at this point. He doesn't really care about that. And we also have him described there in verse 8 as being unjust. He's just done something that isn't good. He's done something that isn't right. So I guess I wouldn't be able to say definitively what about it, what about these moves makes them so clever, makes them so shrewd. I do think we've hit on it a minute ago, but the primary point seems to be boiling down to he's doing something sneaky and it's paying off for him, and there's something about that that makes it good. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting thought there. I'm going to do something good for you. Why don't you remember this? Why don't you be in a position to help me out when I need it? That is kind of in reverse there. Looking at this is how I will want to be treated. So I'll make that palatable for them, and maybe that will be the way things go. Linda, did you? Yeah, that is a good point, and that's always been kind of a funny reaction to me that the Pharisees have when Jesus makes these statements, and I think they're largely reacting to what he'll say in 9 through 13, this kind of related but to a large degree separate kind of riff that he goes off on wealth itself and mammon and looking at the treasures or the riches of this world. And he says, you got to choose. You can't serve God and mammon. You can't have both of those things as your guiding force. And it's funny to me that they deride him for that. They're kind of laughing at that idea, I guess, because of what Luke tells us there. They were lovers of money. I guess there was just something about that thought to them that was kind of funny. I mean, it just kind of caused them to snort and say, what a naive man is really the sense that you get. He just doesn't understand how the world works. He thinks it's that simple to just divorce those two things and only be a servant of God. But the point that Jesus makes there in verse 15 is I think in large part what we're dealing with there. What's highly esteemed among men is an abomination in the sight of God. He's not looking at things the same way we are in all circumstances. Other comments, questions while we're on those lines? Yeah, Robert?
Sure. So I think it is important to always keep in mind that our
Yeah. New King James is unrighteous. I think, did you say dishonest was one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
false.
Whatever it is, it's man, which
yeah.
is exactly what we have over here.
Yeah.
And the next verse is, and so the point is, you're going to be dealing with money. You're going to be dealing with stuff in life, in society. And I don't think he's saying use dishonest or unjust money. He's saying use money, but in God-honoring ways.
Right. Yeah.
Railed on this guy, the whole society who just, I mean, their economy just got boomed because everyone now doesn't have to pay a ton of money to this guy. There's a lot of yes going on.
Yeah.
And he hurts this guy in some manner. Then the society, that community is going to see that and go, oh, we're going to be for
yeah.
him and not for you. And so he gets that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't be like them in that way, but be like them in understanding your community. But point toward God. Hopefully you can use this in perhaps almsgiving or something else, using your money, you're helping people, you're helping the community, like this guy did, but in other ways with your money in such a way that it is honoring to God, that love God, loves your neighbor.
Right. Yeah. 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 Get ahead in business, make a lot of friends, those kinds of things. Yeah. They would have thought, good, he's approving of what we do. That we finally agree on something, Jesus. I mean, you're telling us that we should do everything that we can to get ahead and line our pockets. All right, we'll deal with the issue. The money aspect of this is a very important aspect of it, but I don't think it's the main lesson. So we'll and even Jesus, I think, kind of tacks it on at the end here. So we'll talk about that in 1 minute. But I do think... You mentioned there the idea of don't do what he's doing, but in some way be like him, be like he's being, and it's in what way in verse 8. He commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly. That's at the very end of the parable proper, and I think that's really what he's driving at as the overarching point. I've mentioned before in looking at this parable the difference between, and many others have mentioned, the difference in what the commendation actually says. He doesn't say, I commend the shrewd steward because he dealt unjustly. That's a very different thing from saying, I commend the unjust steward because he dealt shrewdly. What he's looking at that is praiseworthy, that he actually did right, isn't that he was a cheater, isn't that he was a schemer and just a bad guy, a crook and a rascal. No, what he did good that I can actually say well done is he was shrewd. He was thinking. He was being smart. He was actually working with everything that he had to reach the end that he knew he needed to reach. So, ultimately, this seems to me to function as an invitation for us to make that point of examination within ourselves. From a spiritual standpoint, am I being wise? Am I being prudent or shrewd, whatever word you want to use, with my duties before God? Examples would be numerous. There would be millions of examples of looking at the world and their practices and seeing people who are, genius, They're good at figuring things out, and they will use every tool available to them to get what they want, and they'll work really hard at it. It's not just that they have a good idea and then just things sort of fall into their lap. They're up at dawn, you know, working to scam people, in this example, kind of, but whatever it might be, you have people that work hard at it. You have people that devote all of their time and energy into meeting their own needs, whatever they might be, using the system that they have to work within to work for them instead of having it kind of work against them. There are people who are brilliant at this, leveraging everything that they have and working with all of their might and using their brains to reach their goal. Do we have any of that attitude and work ethic and drive within us when we are looking at our spiritual goals? Are we working as hard at being sons of light as these sons of this world are working at doing whatever they're trying to do in this generation? And that's really what Jesus says there in verse 8. Most of the time, no, we're not. The sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light. Oftentimes, we're kind of shamed by the work ethic and the shrewdness or prudence or whatever it is of everyone else who's trying to meet their earthbound, often dishonest, often unjust goals. Now I have something that actually would be a good end to accomplish, and I'm just, well, if it gets done, it gets done. Somebody else will do it. Doesn't really matter. It's just church, you know, whatever the attitude might be. That's not something we can afford to do. So I think through this, Jesus is saying, you be like him in that you got to hand it to him. When things started going bad, he does everything he can. He's looking around. What kind of deal can I make? What can I do? How can I have this actually end up well for me? And whatever it takes, he's going to do it. So that to me seems to be the primary purpose we're looking at here. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Yeah, they do definitely have pretty different shades of meaning that we tend to use them with, but I don't know how much of that has been developed modernly. I don't know kind of when that divide started, and And I think that is what is being looked at here. We have maybe a negative connotation with that word, but it is just an idea of being wise, being smart, looking at the options available and choosing the one that will see what you need to happen actually end up happening. Robert? Yeah. Then that color is how we perceive and understand some of this. And I do see a difference between true and prudence, but not necessarily a negative positive. It's culturally, I think we do have that kind of distinction. There are a bunch of other words we could use that are colored in certain Yeah.
If you said something is, oh, that's quite nice, well, we would say that's positive. You're elevating that nice in an elevated way. If you're British, you comment if someone asks you a question what they thought of the reason, it was quite nice. They're actually putting it lower.
It's like saying it was okay.
Right.
Yeah.
But being nice about it.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe that wasn't going to happen because that's the thing is still in society. That guy would never do that to him because of the honor shame and stuff. And the economy just went up.
Yeah.
Because everyone was blessed in that. But still, not God.
Yeah. Two very different ways of using that. Two very different ways of responding to riches and to wealth, or to their absence, or about to be sudden absence. Neither one good on face value. And interesting that both men end up yet being praised for something. One, for coming to his senses and coming back. That's good. That's smart. You do that. This man for doing something that had a bit of wisdom to it. All right, let's look at, beginning there in verse 9 through 13, there are some sayings added to the end of this parable that take it into some of those kind of related questions that we've looked at, especially the idea of wealth, which we've already touched on a couple of times. And that verse 9 is an interesting verse. I say to you, make friends for yourselves by unrighteous mammon, that when you fail, they may receive you into an everlasting home. We just don't have time to kind of unpack everything that's there, but I would offer as maybe the biggest weird part to look at, I guess, for right now, is just the idea of unrighteous mammon. There again is a word that sounds to us, gives kind of a definite picture of what that means. What does unrighteous mammon sound like? Ill-gotten gains, right? Just the same kind that this guy was dealing with. It's money that you stole. It's money that you cheated somebody out of. It's something that doesn't belong to you, and it's, you know, you shouldn't have got it how you got it. I think in large part what he is saying there, though, when he is talking about unrighteous mammon, will be in contrast to what he ends up talking about in verse 11, the true riches. Those are the two things that are being compared, true riches and unrighteous mammon. I would submit my understanding of this, any money that I have, anything in my bank account right now, is unrighteous mammon. It's all the same stuff. Now, I didn't steal any of it. Y'all are starting to kind of look worried. What was he doing before he came here to Tulsa? Was he, you know, running a mob down there in Houston? No. I'm not a crook. I'm not a criminal. It's unrighteous mammon from the standpoint of it's not true. And that word unrighteous is often translated false. It's just false mammon. I think your version you mentioned a moment ago, dishonest. It's false. It's an illusion. It's all just like everything in this world. All that material stuff is illusory. It's false. You can't trust it. You can't count on it. It's not going to be there for very long. It's not true riches. So, make friends for yourselves by unrighteous mammon. Jesus, again, is not saying, yeah, go out, cheat people, make a bunch of money by a bunch of scams and schemes, and then use that to buy some friends and become buddies with everybody. Instead, what he is saying there is, use your whatever wealth you have. We're all going to have some wealth. We're all going to have some interaction with the goods and the possessions and the things of this world. Use those wisely. In particular, the specific thing he's saying there is to make friends for yourselves by doing that. There might be a specific connection there in verse 9 to saying that when, and again, there's another kind of weird translation, when you fail or when it fails or when all things fail, then they may receive you into an everlasting home. Maybe the idea is there of looking at other people being able to participate with you of those true riches, and so you will all be there together. It could just be the idea in verse 9 that you may be received into an everlasting home. He's just looking at similar, very similar to what Jesus would say in the Sermon on the Mount. You don't lay up for yourself treasure on earth. You lay it up in heaven. That's where you have stored everything that you value. And it would be a similar point here. That's what you're actually hoping to attain to. But that's the question for ourselves. How do we view it? We can view it like the Pharisees did and like many people do all over the world and always have. I'm going to use it so that I can get ahead. I'm going to use it so that I can cheat other people, so that I can be number one. And really it ends up becoming your master. That's what Jesus talks about in the rest of this section, that you're going to have to choose one. And money can certainly be a master to us if our decisions are made with that thought in mind, that this will lead to greater financial gain, or this will just lead to better physical circumstances right now. It's really just kind of the same thing. That's your master. That is what you're serving. That's what guides you and who you're listening to, who gives the orders. Jesus says, don't do that. Now, on the other hand, you don't have to go so far to the other end and so far on the other side of the spectrum that, like many have decided to do for centuries, just try to, what God wants us to do is just to remove yourself entirely from anything that has to do with the physical world. Go live in a monastery on the top of a mountain where you don't see anybody else for the rest of your life and you don't own anything. You eat a half of a crust of bread every day and you wear a tiny little rag and you don't have anything that belongs to you, because that would be sinful. That would all be unrighteous mammon. That's not what God wants us involved in, right? That's not what he's saying either. He's saying, use it well. Use it wisely. Use it in a way that honors God, as was said earlier. Make sure that we are handling those things in a way that will be beneficial to the kingdom of God, in a way that will ultimately end up working the most good. Now, with the couple minutes I have left, just another concern that he mentions here, beginning in verse 10, is the idea of faithfulness. And that's really what proves who we are. Are we proving ourselves to be faithful in even the small things? He makes a few contrasts between those true riches and that unrighteous mammon. One of them being, in verse 12, that all belongs to someone else. I mean, nothing we have here on this earth is really ours. Your name might be on the deed. You know, you might have some attachment to it and you view it as yours, but really it's all another man's. It's all someone else's. You don't get to keep any of it. It's not permanent. But all of these ideas are kind of working from lesser to greater. If we can't be trusted in small things, how can we be trusted in greater things? So be faithful in everything. Examine your whole life. Am I deficient in some regard? Are there things that I need to be working harder at? Are there things that I need to be more careful about? Be faithful in everything. If we can wisely use those things that are kind of being loaned to us by the Lord, the earthly trinkets and so forth, then we might be able to be counted on to serve him faithfully instead of defecting over to the other side. And that's what he is looking for, people who will serve him faithfully. So, all right, I have run out of time. Matthew chapter 18 is where we're going to be next week. Matthew chapter 18, beginning in verse 21, which there again is another parable given in the midst of a larger and very cohesive set of teachings dealing with forgiveness. Really, you could go all the way back to the beginning of chapter 18 for that one. But Matthew 18, the parable of the unforgiving servant, is where we'll be next Wednesday night. Thank you very much. Really appreciate the comments and discussion tonight. We'll have just a couple minutes break, and then Andy is going to be delivering an invitation. We'll have a few minutes rest. Thank you very much.